Welcome to the Mostly Mom podcast, where we have conversations about being a mom and all the other things we do along the way that make us who we are. Hi, I'm Kristen Shelvin. While my days are filled with many roles and responsibilities, Mostly Mom is my favorite title. I think normal moms have the best stories, but they don't usually get to share them. I'd like to take some time to sit down with a fellow mom to discuss the good and the hard, the joy and the sorrow, what we're facing in our current season of motherhood, and lessons we've learned along the way. I hope you are encouraged, challenged, and inspired by these conversations. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi.
Mrs. Vine. I feel like I can't call you Cheryl. I need to call you Coach Vine or Mrs. Vine. Thanks for being here.
Of course.
I have been looking forward to chatting with you. And I just want to start where I've always started these conversations and would love to just hear you tell your story.
Oh, that's such a big question. Okay. I grew up in Minnesota in a family of five kids. I'm the second oldest. And I grew up in a really small community of church and attached school where I attended from K through 12. So that was kind of our whole life was wrapped up in that church and school community. They were very much the same. I also grew up with a lot of extended family, very close. So birthday parties and holidays were always big family affairs. Was an athlete in high school. That was kind of, I felt like a really key part of my identity. I had always been a tomboy and more interested in playing basketball and soccer with the boys than doing whatever the girls were doing. So in high school, I was in all the sports I could be in, which is the benefit of a small school, mm-hmm. right? You get to be a star when you wouldn't have even made the team in a public school. So, and then I went to college in California, just north of LA, to a Christian liberal arts school. And Cody and I, my husband, met while I was in school. He was actually in the Navy, but some of his friends went to school with me. And we pretty much fell in love right away. And we're sure that we were going to get married, maybe by like our second interaction. But he was in the Navy still. He had 2 years left of his 6 years. And so we spent our entire dating very much long distance. And he was often on an aircraft carrier and couldn't even reliably, you know, talk on the phone or email or anything. So it was a really interesting way to spend our dating life. But we got married in 2005 and moved to Bozeman. We moved here because he was going back to school at MSU. He's from northeastern Montana. And I didn't know what I was going to do. After we moved here, I didn't work for about the first 6 months, I think. And then I started working as a floral designer at Langer's, which I loved. It was an amazing job. I had worked at a florist and greenhouse as my college job over the summers, but I wasn't a designer. And so once I got to start actually designing flowers, it was, well, maybe not my dream job. I wasn't using my degree, but it was just a really, really lovely thing to do. And then I started substitute teaching. I was really intrigued by this school where these kids read all of these great books that I wasn't exposed to until college, mm-hmm. and learn Latin, which, again, I hadn't been exposed to until college. And so I was just, I kind of wanted to go back to high school, mm-hmm. but I ended up substituting, and then their Latin teacher was leaving the next year. So I started teaching Latin and started coaching volleyball. Then about 5 years into our marriage, we had our first baby in 2010 and decided to move to Minnesota to be closer to my family. And just for housing prices, on Cody's job at the time, we couldn't afford to buy a house in Bozeman. So moved back to Minnesota, bought a house in St. Cloud, and I started teaching online at a classical school. Did that for 5 years while we had our three more kids. That was really a great setup because I could teach from home and still be there with my kids, but still use that. I had really grown to love teaching Latin and using that part of my brain, especially while having little kids. Mm-hmm. The first year, the only year that I wasn't teaching was the first year after Tyler was born, and I kind of thought I was going to go a little crazy just not doing any kind of intellectual engagement with other people. Mm-hmm. I knew I needed to do something just to keep that part of my brain alive. So after 5 years of teaching online, and then we had four kids by then, my oldest was about to go into kindergarten. And so I was looking around in central Minnesota, and there were no classical schools, co-ops, although there was a CC group starting. So I just put out a question on our church's website for leads. Like, does anybody know of anything happening in this classical education in this area? And through that, a few moms, two other moms, and I started a classical school for our kids, basically, which is how I think it usually starts. We had 12 kids mm-hmm. the first year, I think. And we started with kindergartners to third graders, and then we had some seventh and eighth graders. So we were going to grow these two groups like a grade at a time. But we ended up the second year filling all the elementary grades. Not wow. filling, but having kids in all the elementary grades. So we went.
In a matter of 1 year, yeah. you went from you and two other moms to basically a fully functioning elementary school.
Yes, K through eight.
Wow.
And then it's harder to get up in the high school grades yeah. when you have just a few, but the elementary filled out really quickly. We had 60 kids by the third year.
Wow.
So yeah, just really a need in that area. And I learned a lot from teaching those particular kids and in that particular school. It was very different than what I had done at my online kids, who are homeschoolers for the most part, just really accelerated. They're choosing their classes, and so they're choosing the program that they want, and some of them were so dedicated and yeah. so there's just a different, there's good and bad things about that online schooling culture. Mm-hmm. But I had some really amazing families to work with. And some of them, you know, I'd teach them in sixth and seventh grade. And I didn't even realize how young they were because we're doing Wheelocks and they're just like killing it. And then they come back 6 years later and ask me for a college recommendation. I'm like, you're just graduating now? Like, how old were you?
So tell us real quick what a Wheelock is for those yes. of us that
so
might not
it's
know.
It's a Latin text that is not used much in high schools anymore. I was teaching it at a junior high level, but it's actually a college text. So it's fairly dry grammatical information. Then it's all Caesar and Cicero for the readings. So you get really, really familiar with Cicero's Catilinarian orations because you're just... Those are like all the exercises. This is a really difficult text for junior high kids.
Oh yeah,
to be in, and that was amazing. I have such good friendships and relationships from those online students that I taught. Not all of them, because you know you'd have 25 in a class, but out of those, like there are some families where I had all five kids, and they would come stop by and see me on summer vacations. Like
yeah,
where you actually there's this idea that you that online teaching is really impersonal, and it can be. There are some families that I don't remember at all. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't know if I saw them, but then one of my students just invited me to his wedding in Livingston.
Wow. Like,
some of them you can really build good relationships with. So
yeah.
So we did that for 3 years where I was teaching online and at the school we had started. And then Cody's job fell through. Not fell through. They wanted him to relocate. And our options were like East Coast, Texas, or Seattle. All big city. They were relocating their whole IT department to the coasts. And so basically that was a no.
Yeah.
And that was in September of our third year at that school. And we were just starting, we're pretty slow relationship builders, community builders.
It takes a long time sometimes to get those roots and connections.
Yeah, it did. Just, it took us a long time. When we were in Bozeman, we had friends that Cody had known from, I mean, his college best friends, his growing up best friends were here in Bozeman. So we had like instant community with them. But it took us a good 5 years in St. Cloud to really, and we were going to the same church the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
But having the school connection really helped when I had teacher friends and my kids had teachers and they had school friends. That really helped. So we had just felt like we had gotten established.
Yeah.
And I loved our house and our property. It was, you know, I was dreaming of kids having weddings in the backyard.
Yeah.
And Cody's job fell through, and I instantly knew God's moving us away from here. And I spent the next 9 months screaming no in my head. And it was strange because I instantly knew that this is what's happening.
Yeah.
And could submit to it in a sort of a, yeah, this is what's happening. I already know. Like, Cody spent a few months trying to find another job locally because he knew I didn't want to leave, but I already knew it wasn't going to work out. I knew we were leaving. I knew we were coming back to Bozeman. I didn't fight it, but in a way I fought it, like, just internally.
Like, cognitively, you know certain things are going to happen and that's good.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's this emotional, spiritual piece of, I don't want it to be this way.
Yeah, yeah. And I couldn't get on board with being excited about it or wanting or even being willing.
Mm-hmm.
Emotional piece just never quite clicked in, even for months after we moved here. Even as I could see that this is good, this is where we're supposed to be,
mm-hmm.
I had to grieve for a really long time. I couldn't look at pictures of my kids in that house or, you know, think about the school going on without us.
Yeah.
It was really, really a huge loss that I had. Yeah, there was just, I had to grieve it. I had to learn to grieve. I didn't really know how to grieve before that. And we have some great community in Bozeman. I knew we were coming back to that. Like, we never stopped visiting when we were in Minnesota. So I knew we had something to pick up with. But that was 7 years ago now. No, 8 years ago. And my oldest is dyslexic and was a year into his remediation, his tutoring for that. So still really struggling. I actually ended up homeschooling the first year we were here, which is not a choice I wanted to make.
Mm-hmm.
And now is a choice I think about every year. I think about going back to that. There's just some really good things about it. And I don't think I'm the right teacher for all of my kids. And I have a lot of friends that do that. And so, yeah, there's just something about that community that, yeah, I would like to be a part of again. But after that first year of homeschooling, my old position came open. And so I went back to teaching Latin again. And I had been teaching online up to that point. The first year, now that I think about it, the first year back was a doozy. It was the change in headmaster. And then the end of the year was the COVID online debacle.
What a time to go back to school.
Right. It was a little insane. And at the time, I think we just wrote it out. Like, you can't really do anything else when you're in the midst of of something like that. But now that I think about it, our very first year back was really disruptive. And it feels a lot more settled now. But so my kids are in 9th, 7th, 5th, and 3rd grade.
Let's go back because I want to talk through a couple things. Did you, when you were in college in California, did you know you wanted to be a teacher?
Oh, absolutely not. I was an English major. So that's the question you always get, right? Like, what are you going to do, teach?
Yeah.
And that was the only thing I said I would never do. So I actually had no training in education. And so I kind of went back just wanting to be a student again to learn better than I had the first time. And in the process of that, I feel like I'm still learning how to do that, but she gave me such a good foundation.
From my perspective of being a former homeschool mom and then a very big cheerleader of teachers and the classical model, I think teachers who have that love of learning and excitement for learning themselves make that whole classroom experience so much better than someone who maybe has the skills of the pragmatic pieces of teaching, but doesn't have that passion and heart of, I love learning about this. That makes a difference.
Yes, I think so.
Why Latin? Why, for someone listening who might be skeptical, why does Latin matter? Why does Greek matter? Why would you want your kid to study all these old languages?
Yeah. I used to have a really tidy handout that was like top 5 reasons for learning Latin. And it was some of the typical like English vocabulary connections and test scores and those things. I don't hand that out anymore. I think families have changed, and the families that are pursuing classical education, I don't know, those reasons just maybe aren't as compelling as I once thought they were. They're still all true. I mean, learning Latin and Greek makes a huge difference in your ability to comprehend English vocabulary. And, you know, can increase test scores, SAT, ACT scores, and things like that. But what I tell my students now is different. So I took Latin in college just because I'm a nerd and love languages, and my professor read something to us in Latin one day, and the college didn't even have a Latin class. And like 10 of us were suddenly insistent that he teach us Latin. So we created a Latin class. They have a classics degree now, but we kind of started that whole thing because it just caught my attention. I thought that was so cool that you could read something in Latin. What I tell my students now, we talk about the way that learning a dead language in particular shapes the way that they are able to think and make connections. Because, and there are some aspects to learning any language would help your brain with these things, but particularly Latin and Greek that are sort of static and timeless because of the way that they have functioned over the centuries, the way that they've been encoded and are unchanging and unevolving now, although there's still some ways, you know, modern vocabulary is still evolving in Latin, but their structure is not evolving the way modern languages are so quickly. And so the pattern recognition and the word choices and styles that we have to wrestle through and that they master, essentially, shapes their ability to think and make connections in every other area. And I think Latin in particular, because it was such a universal language for so long, my students are usually really surprised as to how long ago it was that everybody was learning Latin. And even, you know, in places like England now, like still many, many of the students, it's just normal that mm-hmm. you're taking Latin. So this kind of access to a way of thinking, to a body of literature that everybody studies. I mean, this is part of our humanities program as well. We're just doing a lot of it in the original language, like as much as they can get access to by the time they're done with 10th grade. Gives them so much insight into just the world conversation, mm-hmm. the way people are writing, the allusions that they're making, the structure of really beautiful sentences. You don't get English, great English literature without the underpinnings of Latin that those people have studied. The great English style even is they've read their Cicero and their Virgil and their Ovid. And that's where those authors are taking that sentence structure from. So even their ability to read English, even things that are being written now or, you know, in the 20th century, is all tied back into Latin.
Yeah. For somebody listening who is maybe not familiar with the classical model of education, mm-hmm. I feel like certain different people might give a different answer to what they think classical is. What would you tell someone classical education looks like?
I think my answer to this has probably evolved as well. It's a question I get a lot from my family. I think I would have maybe originally started with, you know, the three stages mm-hmm. of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, which is still, those underpinnings are still there, and it is a way to see classical education as we see the grammar stage as a time for acquiring the grammar of every subject, not just of language, but the grammar of history, the basic facts,
all the data, all the facts, all the knowledge.
Yes, all the hooks that they can pin things on later. And then the logic stage, being a time where they're not just learning formal logic, but are also in a stage where their brains are primed to start to make arguments, to question things, and to put things together in logical pieces, to take all those grammar pieces and start to flesh them out a little bit. And then the rhetoric stage being where they acquire the ability to express themselves persuasively and with all of the formal rhetorical skills that were classically acknowledged throughout the centuries as being the way of an orator, the ability to speak persuasively and well.
To think well, to write well.
Yes.
Because they have read well.
Yes. So I think that still works as an explanation. I think I've started to think of the classical model as having a lot to do with the integration of subjects. And I don't think that classical schools all do this well.
Yeah.
I think it's difficult to do in a typical structured school schedule, and it's something that we're always pushing against.
Yeah.
And I think it's a little easier. This is one of the draws of homeschool for me, is to have my kids sitting around just reading together and doing all of the noticing and fact gathering and putting things together and expressing things well across whatever we're doing mm-hmm. together at their appropriate stage. And that's one of the things I really miss about homeschool. It's so easy to get locked into this is what we do in humanities. That bell rings, and then this is what we do in math.
Yep.
And those two don't cross, and they shouldn't. I think we work really hard for that not to be the case, but it is something you constantly have to strive against. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when they're reading something in humanities and it's in Latin, the students tend to get offended if I'm like, why don't we just read that in Latin? I'm like, because that's our humanities class.
It's all connected. Like, history is literature.
Yeah.
Geography. It can all happen at the same time.
Yes.
I always thought science and art should happen at the same
yes.
time.
Yes. Yeah. I love that. And I think that's a big part of classical learning, that it's not separate specialties. You're mm-hmm. not a math person or you're a human. All humans math and all humans read and yep. should be able to read well. And
life isn't broken into these seven subjects.
Yeah.
When you get into the real world, you're doing all the things at the same time.
Right.
Yeah. I love that. You were busy teaching and raising little people. I love what you said about knowing yourself well enough to know that you needed that intellectual stimulation. Like, I talk to all these moms with these conversations that I'm having, and some moms clearly know that they need to stay home. They're called to be at home for all these years. A lot of moms are fully knowing that they're called to homeschool. And then there are a lot of these moms who they know that they need something outside of being a mom. Your kids have gotten to see that, and your interest in the intellectual mind. What does it look like at home for you as someone who has that brain and someone who's a teacher, and particularly a Latin teacher? Like, what does dinner look like around your table?
That's a great question. I love the way that has played out in our family. And I don't feel like it's something that I've done. I have amazing kids. Everybody agrees on this. And I also always say, I didn't do that. Like, I didn't. It's nothing that we did that was like, look at what these kids can do. Partially, I think it is because they've been fed by such great teachers mm-hmm. in both of the schools that we've been in. But they are at a stage now where they are just delightful to converse with. And there are so many connections that come in from what they are reading. This is the effect of classical education that I love, is that at home, we get to see the integration in how they play. My kids are wildly imaginative. The younger three still, even though, you know, the oldest of those three is 12, they can just make a game out of whatever they have sitting around. Mm-hmm. And it's got, you know, pieces of medieval history in it and rainforest culture. And, like, they're just so creative with everything that has been taught to them. Like, they take in information, but it's not information, and they don't come home and drop it. It's actually shaping who they are at home. So our conversations, you know, are not always brilliant, but they are always wild mm-hmm. with just the things that they come up with and the things that they say that I didn't even realize they had learned. And the artwork mm-hmm. that is hanging in my house, I'm very not picky about what they hang up. So I just have, it's all over the place on every wall, just the wildest things that they're learning to draw. And not a single one of them questions whether they're an artist because of the art teachers that they've had, because of just the classroom teachers mm-hmm. that they've had. They have no doubt that they can draw and paint and, you know, try new media. They have no inhibitions about that. And so, yeah, the connections that they make and the way that they the way that they play and imagine and create, it's really delightful. Mm-hmm. It's delightful to watch, and I'm so thankful for the teachers that they have that make that possible. That's one thing I don't think they would get just from me. Mm-hmm. If we were homeschooling, they would create plenty of things, but I don't think it would be quite as broad.
Mm-hmm. Busy families need all the help they can get to stay organized. Enjoy your ordinary everyday as you manage your household with these easy-to-use printables. These digital download planning pages include sheets for homework, chores, summer activities, meal planning, weekly calendars, year-at-a-glance planning, and more. Make your fridge look cute, or create a family binder to keep everyone organized. Purchase once and print forever. Weekly planning pages are bundled in Monday Start or Sunday Start format. For a limited time, buy the bundles at a 40% discount and get the liturgy prints as a bonus. The Get Ready Checklist and Summer Checklist are my favorites. Each of my kids knows exactly what's expected, and they take responsibility for what's on their list. Not just for the kids, there are also downloads you can use for vacation planning, grocery shopping, and habit tracking. Go to ordinaryeveryday.studio for the link.
What has been a specific joy for you in motherhood, and what has been a specific joy for you with your work?
In motherhood, I'm going to go with the nerdy answer. My two oldest are both now in secondary, so I have them both as students. I was really nervous about that with my oldest. I was just nervous about a lot of things with him going into seventh grade a couple of years ago. And he just crushed it right away. Like, all of the concerns that I had with transitioning to secondary and with the higher expectations, he just really came into his own in secondary. Like, this was always the level he was meant to be at, and he just owned it and had developed all the right skills. I can't even tell you how proud I was of him that first year, and how much less difficult it was than I thought it was going to be. I mean, he's learning Latin. He's in Latin 3. Which is, you know, the end of all of Latin grammar and starting to just read texts. And I don't know how many people know this, but dyslexic kids aren't supposed to even attempt to learn language. Like, that's what all the advice that we were given. Like, don't ever make him take a language class. If he has to, make it like American Sign Language or something. Mm-hmm. And when he came into fourth grade, the elementary Latin teacher, who's my very good friend, and I were like, well, you're his mom. He's going to learn Latin. Let's just try it and see. And if we have to make accommodations, we will. He's just always done okay, done well. And so I have these two secondary kids that I get to be in the hallways with all the time. And they are both now big Doctor Who fans with me. And Cody has never been a Doctor Who fan, so it was always my own thing. And now I have these two people to share this very nerdy, very British passion with. And it is just the best. It's just so fun to be able to share that with them, and that they get all of these nerdy jokes, and that, yeah, is a joy. They're fun people to be with.
Yeah.
I mean, they still need plenty of parenting.
Of course.
But it's not the constant, you know, of the little years, the constant input and correction. Now they're just fun to be with. Mm-hmm. And I know you have the same with your oldest. Mm-hmm. She's just a delightful human.
She's a pretty great human.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Joy in, what was the other one?
Joy with your work.
With my work. Mm-hmm. Well, right now I'm just missing my work.
Yeah.
Having been off for these 2 months, trying to get healthy in the middle of a school year, something I never, never thought I would, you know, ever need to do. We don't have huge classes mm-hmm. yet. Our biggest this year is 26 seventh graders, but they're split into two sections. So, you know, I've got maybe 50 students across my four levels of Latin every year. And you don't build the same relationship with every student. Mm-hmm. Like, you have the same amount of time with all of them, and you try to give them all the same amount of attention. But there are just students that you build a lifelong relationship with.
Yeah.
And there's maybe one or two a class sometimes. And sometimes you know early, like when you get them as seventh graders, there's just a connection. You have to kind of live that out while they're still students as mm-hmm. still student and teacher. But you just know, like, this is a person I'm going to be friends with for a lot of years. And that is probably the most joy that I get from teaching, is just those relationships where you've been able to just feed into them as a person mm-hmm. And get to know them really well. You don't get to know all of your students really well, but sometimes they let you in to their lives in a way that that goes beyond the classroom. Mm-hmm. And that's just really, really precious. And the end of that, the result of that, the friendship that comes out of that is brings me a lot of joy.
Yeah. Is there something that you've dreamt of doing for a long time?
There is, actually.
And why haven't you done it?
I've always wanted to be a writer. And for a few years, a lot of years, maybe while I was first teaching and while I was having kids, it was I'm not sure exactly what I want to write. Mm-hmm. And so I would dabble with things, but there was also just not a lot of time or sleep in those years. And so that's maybe why I kind of thought, when the kids are a little older, I'll sit down and figure out what I want to write. Cody really wants me to write the next Harry Potter, but the next series that sells millions and millions of things so he doesn't have to work anymore. But I don't think that's where I'm going. For a few years now, I've known what I want to write. I've started it a few times. I guess you would basically call it my memoir, but I might fictionalize it. I don't know. I have a life story that I haven't quite told on this podcast or anywhere, that just a few people know, that I definitely want to put in writing. It's a really difficult story to tell, and it's difficult to sit in it long enough to get it down.
Yeah.
So the things that I have written, I have maybe, I don't know, 50 pages of it or something. When I walk away from it, I don't hold on to, like, I can only sit in it when I'm actually forcing myself to write it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually part of this unforeseen sabbatical that I'm on. Part of the gift of this time off in a mysterious way has been learning to accept the whole story, all the pieces that I have now, because it came in pieces, and to just hold the whole thing, let the whole thing be true. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if maybe that'll be written soon. I don't know.
And I have to mention, because we're not on video, we're just audio, that you are in deep chronic pain.
Yes.
With a pretty severe injury, ongoing injury that you've been managing that has now taken you away from work. And maybe talk for a minute about that journey of accepting what's there in front of you. And it seems like learning to sit with all of that.
Yeah.
Not in a way that you wanted to, but knowing that you needed to. Yeah. And what that means for being a mom and teacher who can't do the level of mom and teacher that you'd like to.
Yeah. It's been it's been acute for the last 2 months, but it's been a long journey. And so, yeah, for the last 6 years, every other year, my back has gone out really severely in the summer. And then I spend the whole summer recuperating. Mm-hmm. And by the time school hits, I'm sort of ready to get back at it. And then there are two other times of the year that it just gets really unstable. And thought it was a disc, had an MRI. There's nothing actually structurally wrong with my back. And so figured out that it's actually my SI joint. But whatever it is, it completely destabilizes my whole ability to hold myself up. I can't walk. I can't sit. And it's just really extreme pain. And so that's been an ongoing journey, mostly manageable. But this past year, it's just gotten more and more unmanageable. And that parenting and teaching and coaching through that has been really difficult. There's a lot of things that I have to tell my kids we just can't do. Even when I'm at my best, I'm always having to think about how long can I sit if we go to that, or what's that going to do to my back if I try to move like that? Like, it's just always a consideration. And there's also just, when you're in terrible pain, you're not usually the person you want to be.
Yeah.
Like, you just you tend to be nasty. It's hard not to be nasty when you just hurt.
Mm-hmm. Everything's so filtered through the pain.
Yes.
It comes out.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't do super well with doctors, and just trying to find someone who could tell me how to manage this has been just really, really difficult. But there's also spiritual and emotional trauma-based side to it. So I don't know if you've read The Body Keeps the Score. Have you?
Yeah, it's fascinating.
So fascinating, yes. And I have learned that my body has held a lot of trauma. Part of coping with that as a child, God has given us these amazing abilities to survive things. And there's a cost to healing from that. So a big part of this is the last 8 years after my last child was born, I went into a really, really serious postpartum depression. And I had it after each birth, but with my last, it was really, really bad. And there was like a timeline where I was supposed to come out of it because I'd been through this three times and I wasn't coming out of it. And that put me in the emergency room and then in emergency counseling for what I thought was postpartum depression, and we'll just get over this and then be done with it. And I'm still in counseling. And the ability of my childhood mind to split things off and hold things and not process things or feel things could only last so long. And once I was safe enough and strong enough and had my own kids, there's just so many factors, right, that can cause all of that to start coming out. And the becoming more whole, the healing of that has meant the weakening of my body in some ways, and that I don't understand all of it, but there's a sense in which, even as I taught over the last year, and part of my prayer last year was that I wanted to be a whole person so that when I'm at school, I mean, I'm in this beautiful community of teachers that I love and know really well, and I wanted my face to be connected with what was actually happening on the inside. And a lot of times that's, I'm just going through a really difficult healing and now I got to come to school and like put on school face. And I don't want to put on school face anymore. Like I want to be a real person.
Like fully integrated.
Yes. Yes. And God has answered that. And that I didn't think about. Maybe I did, but sometimes what that means then is that I'm actually as broken as I am, like in real time.
Yeah.
Like in class or in front of my coworkers. School has always been, since I was young, these are things I'm just learning. School's my hold it all together mechanism because I have strong intellectual abilities and can thrive in that environment and did as a child. And so that's where I was perfect and everything was fine. And letting that go, it's been really messy.
Yeah. And how beautiful that you've got this group of people now who you can be broken physically and emotionally with. That's such a gift to have those people around you in support rather than, and again, I know you have the full story to tell later, some other time, but how that counteracts how it used to be.
Yeah.
That you couldn't
be
broken and vulnerable and fully yourself. And now you are and you can be.
Yes.
And even that right there is such a beautiful piece of your story.
Yeah, it's beautiful and also something I would never ask for.
No.
Right? Yes.
Yeah.
And my kids are at an age where they don't need me all of the time. They're pretty self-sufficient. They help with dinner. They, you know, entertain each other and themselves. Mm-hmm. And I'm thankful for that. And I also, it's another piece to grieve that so much of their childhood, I have been just broken in one way or another. And in a way, I'm thankful for that because I'm not passing down to them the same cycle of hiding and holding it together. Like, in a way, it's very much for them that I've stuck with this journey. Not that I could get off the roller coaster, but that I've stayed on, knowing that me breaking these cycles is actually helping them in the long run, even if it feels like it's taken me away from them.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I'm not stuck in my room, I've just not always as available to them as I wanted to be, and yet. It's also for them. There's failure in that, and there's gratitude in that as well.
Considering, Cheryl, your unique situation, what's some wisdom that you could pass along to someone in your same shoes that you would, like, cup their chin and tell them, if you could tell them?
Yeah. I think there are so many ways to let the darkness win. It's so real, the temptation to give up. There are just ways that evil wants to destroy us and keep us captive. And I've lived through miraculously, not on my own strength, lived through so much of that I really shouldn't have survived. And so, if I were speaking to someone a little behind me on the road and the same kind of of journey, I think I would just whisper, light wins.
Hmm.
The light has already won because I know it doesn't look like it.
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard to believe that sometimes, even holding the enormity of my story, even now after all the healing that I've experienced in the last 8 years, looking at the whole thing, it can still feel impossible. And yet I've seen God come through so many times without me being able to exert an ounce of faith. Like, no, this one's actually impossible. I'm just going to give up now. And so many times someone has had to tell me, yeah, you're not crazy. It does actually look like that.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like there's no way out. There is. Don't let go yet.
You might not see it yet.
Yeah.
It's there somewhere.
It's there. You can't see it. I'll hold on to hope. You just don't give up yet.
I love the idea of borrowing hope
mm-hmm.
from someone else.
Mm-hmm.
That they will give you theirs when you need it.
Yeah. And I think we need that, right? We have such an individualistic culture
mm-hmm.
that we can tend to think that we have to muster all the hope and faith to keep going, and it's not going to come from anywhere else. And it's just not true.
Yeah.
We have to have other people who can hope for us when we can't.
Mm-hmm. It's like that image from the Old Testament, and I am going to forget who it was, but was it Moses?
Yes,
when they lifted up his arms for him because he didn't have the strength to
yes.
hold his own arms up. And so he's got one person on one side and one person on the other, and he could just that feeling of just collapsing into someone else holding up, and that beautiful image that we aren't called to do it by ourselves, and we do actually need other people to do this with us.
Yeah.
It's beautiful when it looks the way it should.
Yes. Yeah.
We could probably talk for another hour.
I'm sure we could.
Which I would love to. Just a couple other questions, if we can. And then I've got a rapid fire for you.
Okay.
What is one thing that you have been just surprised by about being a mom and motherhood?
From the time my kids were just littles, it has always surprised me and continues to surprise me how much, I don't know what you call it, grace, unconditional love they have for me.
Mm-hmm.
Just little things like how much they love to hear me sing. I'm not a good singer, but when they're little, especially, just them begging for me to sing to them, or just how quickly they forgive yeah. your anger or your bad disciplining or your, you mm-hmm. know, just their love has always surprised me.
Yeah. What's something that you wish you could have known earlier on?
I wish I could have known that I didn't have to be perfect. And that sounds kind of broad, but
it covers so much of what motherhood looks like.
Yes.
Like getting the food right, getting the
traditions right.
Everything
yes.
right.
Getting
the pressure's so big.
So big. And there's so many things that you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're so aware of all the things you're doing wrong or just not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And through my own therapy and healing, I read a lot, listen to a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I've just learned a lot about attachment theory and what kids actually need. I wish I had known that.
Me too.
Yeah. And it's taken, you know, having to reparent myself to learn to even give them those things.
Mm-hmm.
And that just felt like I lost a lot of time. like their young years. Like if I could have given them that when they were little, how cool would that be?
Yeah. You know? And then there's also the piece of, I think of, it's a quote I came across my first year of homeschooling by St. Jerome. Mm-hmm. And it said, it's ours. I get this wrong all the time. I'll have to find it and say it right.
Yeah.
It's our job to do what we can, and it's his job to do the rest. Mm-hmm. And I, like my first year of homeschooling, I tell the story that I forgot all about grammar for like 6 months.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's kind of an important thing to remember, Kristen. And I came across that quote the same week, and I thought, oh, I needed to hear that, that I feel like I've given my kid this huge deficit.
Yeah.
And the image that I always had in my head was potholes in a road, that the Lord would either smooth the road over so the pothole didn't matter, or he and I would go back and we could fill it. And we caught up on grammar that summer.
Yeah.
But just with parenting and all the ways I think that we don't know what we don't know and want to look back and do things differently. And then the reminder that the Lord is really kind to either let us go back,
yeah,
and revisit the thing and redo it and address it.
Yeah.
Or he will cover it over so it didn't matter that we forgot or didn't have capacity or didn't know any better. I hold on to that quote so much.
Yeah.
Just in my mom job.
Yeah. Just the fact that there is repair. Mm-hmm. Like, it's really, like, God is not bound by time and can actually, like, we get so stuck in the, but that was in the past, I can't make it better. Mm-hmm. Actually, he can. Mm-hmm. He can do this crazy time travel thing that actually mends old, like, time doesn't mend the wounds, but God can go back and undo the time in a way that is hard to describe, but very real. And such a comfort, mm-hmm, that repair is possible and not ever too late or too broken.
Have you ever read called Astrophysics for Normal People?
No.
Something like that by Neil deGrasse Tyson?
No.
It's fascinating, that whole, you know, Einstein's theories.
Yeah.
And how if you really get nerdy and start thinking about it too much, it just, it's bonkers.
Yeah.
That things work that way, actually.
Yeah.
Out there somewhere. Are you ready for the rapid fire? Here's your goal.
Okay.
Answer each of these in a minute or less.
Put a timer on me?
I'm watching, okay. But I'm not going to, like, beep you and cut you off.
You should get, like, a buzzer.
Like the what's the game? Taboo. That buzzer was always the best buzzer.
Yes.
Okay, what are you reading right now?
Oh, I am reading Richard Powers' The Overstory and Alessandro Manzoni's Italian novel, The Betrothed. I'm not reading it in Italian, so don't be impressed, but both really good, rich, large books that are the kind of story that are like woven together, especially The Overstory, where you know he's going to bring it together, but he's just handing you all these pieces of stories. I love that.
Hmm.
So I'm about halfway through both of those.
This is what you get to do now.
Yes.
Yeah. What's the first thing on a normal day?
Okay.
Not maybe for you right now.
Yeah.
What's the first thing you do in the morning?
I'm trying to make this normal for my, once I get back to my routine, so we'll go with this is just listening to Lectio Divina, mm-hmm, app that has a little bit of room for meditation, because I'm not awake enough in the morning to open something and read it myself, but having the first thing be to listen to something that leads me through the scripture passage, hoping to make part of my routine once I actually have to get up early again.
Yeah. What's the last thing you do at night?
Read, for sure. Mm-hmm. I always read for a while before I go to bed.
What's saving the day right now?
Powerful painkillers. No, my kids. are saving the day right now because I say, okay, we need 3 kinds of Christmas cookies baked today. So we have like 12 kinds of Christmas cookies, and they're like, okay, I'll do this one, I'll do this. Mm. And they go and bake. And I love that they're old enough to do things. And I can't even help them right now, but mm-hmm. they are keeping some normalcy around our house that I can't.
Yeah. What's something that people get wrong about you?
People can't imagine that I was ever an athlete, usually.
Oh, that's funny.
I know. It's very strange. I mean, not usually the people who know me as a coach, obviously, mm-hmm. but other people who know me only as a Latin teacher. Can't really imagine that I ever was a sports person.
You are overwhelmed, caught in a moment of anxiety or stress. What is the first thing that you do?
How much time do I have to do this first thing?
That's as much time as you want.
Oh, okay. I grab my rosary and I walk and pray a rosary. This is part of the story that didn't come up. I am Catholic in belief now, but haven't joined the church yet. But I learned to pray the rosary probably 3 years ago, maybe, before I was even like 50% Catholic in belief. And it was a little bit of a struggle for me at first. I had to come to it slowly. Mm. And then I just saw so much fruit from even doing little pieces of it. Mm. Like I would do just the parts that were scripture. So it's like, that can't hurt to pray. But especially if I'm moving, if I'm walking mm-hmm. and praying, but even if I'm just using the beads, and I've used several different kinds of prayer beads now, not just the rosary, but I find it so helpful for getting out of my head. Mm-hmm. So I get so trapped, and then my prayers just become my head spinning, but I'm trying to direct it to God, and that it doesn't break me out of any kind of overwhelm spiral.
But having something to focus in on and replace
yes.
the spinning with a word or a scripture or a breath.
Yes. Yeah. And I've come to describe the rosary as like a kind of holy multitasking. I used to be really good at multitasking, but it was actually because I was just so split that I could actually do different. I wasn't giving my whole self to any of them.
Yeah.
But this kind of, it's such a unifying, you're meditating on 5 different mysteries of Christ's life while praying, you know, the Our Father and the Hail Mary and the Glory Be, while also offering your own intentions. And somehow all 3 of those happen at the same time in a way that's really soothing and also like really focusing. It's a practice I've just really come to appreciate.
Describe an ordinary everyday moment that brings you joy.
So in these 2 months I've been off, it's been a lot of up and down. Some weeks I've actually been able to walk quite a bit. The last 2 weeks I haven't. But I think that's one of the most healing things is to, especially if I can get out in nature somehow. So my greatest joy is watching muskrats play on the pond across from our house. So if I can get out and walk around that trail and play with the muskrats, just watching them, it's such a simple thing. They're just little rat-like things, but they bring me so much joy. And combined with the fresh air and the reflections on the pond, nature really has always been a very healing thing. And even if it's just out in the neighborhood, my world has gotten so small right now, but even just walking around in my neighborhood is really restorative and brings a lot of life.
Yeah. Any last words, Cheryl? Anything we forgot to talk about?
Oh, man. Oh, I crochet. Let's talk about that. That also is an everyday moment that brings me delight. I love to crochet blankets, especially designed by this particular blogger in England. She usually creates 2 blankets a year, but every January and February she does a crochet along.
Oh, fun.
And it's all just free, but you order the blanket pack that has like 15 different colors of yarn. And she designs her blankets around some theme. So one year she did dahlias. One year she did a moorland blanket that was like the Northern England moors in their purple bloom.
Oh, cool.
But the blanket was like ground up to sky. So it was like greens and browns up through the purples and then the blues.
Beautiful.
And so she gives you, she's so generous. She gives you the pattern for free, gives you a certain number of stripes every week. And so you're just crocheting along with thousands of people. And I have blankets all over my house, and my husband thinks there are way too many. They bring me so much delight, and I love seeing my family cozy up with them.
Yeah. Cheryl, thanks for being here, and I have a feeling we'll do this again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I hope we do.
Yeah, thanks.
The Mostly Mom podcast is a production from Ordinary Everyday Studio. Find us on Instagram and online at ordinaryeveryday.studio. Audio and editing by Logan Tomorrow. Thank you for listening.